Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. As a kid, a common experience at birthdays was when I or one of my friends opened a cool new gadget or toy, went to play with it, and it didn't turn on. Of course, when you looked at the box, it said, "Batteries not included." The birthday kid's parents had forgotten to get the batteries, and a hasty trip to the store was arranged. These days, the batteries do tend to come with our gadgets because they're rechargeable. Just plug them in for a while, and it's all good. Having a new toy not work may not be the biggest deal, but in a way it does remind us how dependent we are on stored energy. From starting cars to running electric vehicles and even bicycles, down to vacuums and hand drills, batteries are everywhere. It's fair to say that we take them for granted, at least when they're charged. But batteries haven't been in general use for a very long time at all, especially rechargeable ones. So how did we get to this point, and how do batteries fit into our future? On this episode of The Butterfly Effect, the charged history and future of the battery.
Every battery has, it's kind of surprisingly simple. It's, made up of one or more cells, and each of these battery cells contains an anode, a cathode, and an electrolyte. And it's the chemical reaction between those. We insert the battery into a flashlight or we turn on our cell phone. Like that's, that's the electricity. My name is Jay Turner, and I'm a professor of environmental studies at Wellesley College, and I recently wrote a book titled Charged, A History of Batteries and Lessons for a Clean Energy Future.
Jay's new book details the remarkable history of batteries. It also looks to the future, because there are environmental challenges we need to overcome as the world moves increasingly toward battery dependence.
The wind up to batteries starts back in the 18th century with Luigi Galvani discovering kind of the frog's legs react when you put two different metals in contact with them, and Volta invents an early version of the battery right at the start of the 19th century. But it's really not until the late 19th century that batteries do start to come into commercial use. And the first batteries were kind of the antecedents of today's AA batteries. They were dry cell batteries that were single use. They were used in kind of early products, like flashlights. The early telephone systems depended on these dry cells. And so, they start coming into more common use kind of right around the start of the 20th century.
I have to take us back for a moment to your comment about frog's legs. Can you tell me about that?
This is kind of in that period where people didn't understand electricity and, how it worked and what electrons were. And, I don't know the details of this history of science, but Galvani was you know, experimenting with frogs' legs and trying to understand what made the muscles work. And you know, what he discovered by accident was, you know, by bringing two different metals into contact with the tissue of the dead frog's leg, that in an electrical current would, you know, go between them, between these two different types of metals. And that was the electrons that were, and the ions that were moving through the electrolyte. And, you know, that was a first clue that, you know, it was possible to generate electrochemical, you know, activity if you had the right kinds of materials. And so, you know, that was a starting point that led towards, you know, the batteries that we depend upon today.
I see. So moving forward in time a little bit, people might be familiar with the old lead acid batteries, like the ones that were used in cars and maybe even bigger vehicles like submarines. What were they and how do they work?
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking about kind of single-use batteries, right? The kind that you put in, you use, and then you have to do something with when they die. But you know, lead-acid batteries were the first kind of large-scale, you know, commercialized rechargeable battery. And, you know, they depend upon different forms of lead in the anode and the cathode, and then the electrolyte is sulfuric acid. And, you know, the real kind of turning point for these lead-acid batteries was the invention of the starter motor for automobiles. You know, before the 1920s, starting an automobile, you know, meant cranking the engine, which turned out to be a really dangerous activity if the engine were to kick back. And so starter motors, which are powered by these lead acid batteries, initially made it much easier and much safer to start automobiles. And very quickly, you know, they became a standard equipment on automobiles. And so as, you know, the automobiles, you know, took off in the 20th century, the lead acid battery industry grew with them. And, you know, kind of a little known fact is that even up until, you know, just recently, even the most advanced electric cars still had a small lead acid starter battery in them for kind of the common, you know, 12 volt services, like, you know, running your power windows and your radio, even in those advanced cars.
Really? Wow. So when did portable alkaline batteries like the ones that we can hold in our hands come along?
Yeah, so those were the batteries that were emerging and being commercialized in the early 20th century. And, you know, they started off being zinc carbon batteries. There's a great advertisement from EverReady from, I don't know, sorry, the 1920s, where, you know, it's 100 different things you can do with your EverReady dry cell battery. You know, one of the big turning points for those batteries is they became standardized. You know, back in the, you know, the start of the 20th century, there were so many different formats of these new dry cell batteries. And, you know, big change was standardizing the batteries and, you know, developing the dimensions for what we now know of as the AA and the AAA batteries. And that work happened in the 1920s and the 1930s. A lot of it was driven by the interests of the military, which wanted to have standardized battery sizes for their military needs and for their procurement policies. And so, you know, by the time, you know, 1930s, 1940s, you know, AA batteries are becoming commonplace. I mean, in some ways, they're almost like a form of infrastructure, because you could buy a AA battery, you know, in many different places in the world, and they would, you know, all work in the flashlights or the radios or, you know, even the, you know, bazooka, the shoulder-fired missile launchers that the Army was counting on.
Can you talk a bit about the advantages and the disadvantages of that battery style?
There are always advantages and disadvantages when it comes to batteries. And, you know, I mean, I guess the most obvious one is that they were single-use batteries. They could not be recharged. They had finite life. And, you know, one of the things that makes batteries really not unique, but just interesting, is that they depend mightily on the quality of the materials, the purity of the materials that go into them. And, you know, producing pure materials is something that industry has gotten better at over time. And so, you know, initially, kind of one of the big challenges, and this is a big challenge during World War II, is that because the materials going into these batteries weren't, you know, as pure as they are now, that the batteries would degrade, that they would lose their charge, especially in humid conditions. And so on the war front and, you know, in the Pacific during World War II, a real challenge was just keeping a fresh supply of batteries available for the military to use. One way that problem was solved was adding mercury to these batteries. And so that became a big waste issue in the 1960s and 1970s as these batteries started being used more and more in people's homes.
Right, right. I was really surprised to learn how much more energy it takes to produce those batteries than they actually end up giving us back as the end users.
I was surprised about that too. I guess not so much surprised that that was the case, but just the scale of mismatch. I mean, it takes, more than 100 times more energy to manufacture one of those AA batteries than it delivers in use. And kind of the irony here is that the industry phased out mercury from single-use batteries in the 1980s and early 1990s. And it's really a great environmental success story because it eliminated the most significant source of mercury from municipal waste. But to do that, the industry had to rely on increasingly pure forms of zinc. Manganese primarily. And the processing that went into making those more pure forms of manganese and actually zinc as well meant that it just required more energy to manufacture those materials and to produce the batteries in the first place. So getting the mercury out was a good thing, but on the flip side, it meant it took a good bit more energy to manufacture those pure materials that made that mercury-free battery work.
Mm-hmm. And so is this idea of the purity of the materials, is that sort of a persistent issue or challenge through the history of batteries?
It is. Refining the materials, whether it's the alkaline manganese single-use batteries, which are the AA batteries that we all know, or if it's the newest lithium-ion batteries, which rely on a whole range of different materials, producing very pure battery-grade materials is important to producing batteries that have long lifespans, that are durable, that can deliver the power that people expect from the batteries. And so it puts a lot of emphasis on the upstream processing of these materials that, and the supply chains that supply the materials for these batteries.
Mm-hmm. These days, of course, we'd be lost without small rechargeable batteries. Can you talk a little bit about the development of the materials used in, say, nickel metal hydride batteries?
Yeah. If you go back to kind of when I was a kid in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, and there were a bunch of different rechargeable battery technologies, and they're increasingly small rechargeable battery technologies that, seem like they were going to kind of enable some kind of portable transition. So nickel metal hydride were important to this. Nickel cadmium batteries were important to this. Even small lead acid batteries, kind of a small version of what had been used so often in vehicles. But just the real turning point was when lithium ion batteries were first commercialized by Sony in 1991. And very quickly over the next decade, the lithium ion batteries displaced those other battery technologies and had become kind of really since the start of the 21st century, the default rechargeable battery chemistry, both for small technologies like our laptops and our cell phones, but increasingly for electric vehicles and even utility scale applications where you're backing up, a whole neighborhood.
Really?
Yeah, that's starting to happen, right? So, one of the interesting things about lithium ion batteries is just in kind of a, I think of it as a step ladder where we've gone from small scale applications to bigger and bigger applications as, knowledge and refinement of this technology has improved. The earliest lithium ion batteries were in camcorders, but, scaling up those battery cells into larger and larger battery packs enabled electric vehicles. And right now it's enabling, large scale battery systems that can store megawatt hours of electricity, which is the scale that you need if you're going to, compensate for when the wind isn't blowing or the, at nighttime when solar panels aren't going to produce to provide backup electricity for the grid.
This is Spark from CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, and this is the second episode of our series, The Butterfly Effect. We're exploring how apparently small developments in technology can have an outsized effect on the world and the way many of us live. This time, the battery. I've been talking to Jay Turner, an environmental studies professor and the author of Charged, A History of Batteries and Lessons for a Clean Energy Future. He'll be back in a little bit. We're actually at a very exciting time in battery development as electric vehicles become ever more popular.
There's five things we're trying to do. So they are decrease the lifetime of lithium-ion batteries, increase the energy density so you can store more energy per unit weight or volume. That translates to larger driving distance in a car. Use lower cost than sustainable materials. Help develop other ways to lower cost. And finally, to either maintain or improve safety of the batteries. So those are the five things that we work on.
This is Jeff Don. He's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Chemistry at Dalhousie University. He's also one of the original developers of the lithium-ion battery.
One of the things that I'm always looking at is battery lifetime, because we're starting to deploy a lot of large battery installations for grid storage from solar and wind, you know, because the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And how long would you like those battery installations to last? You know, I look at it and say, these are virtually a piece of public infrastructure, like a bridge. You know, you want a bridge to last 60, 70 years. And why not the same for, you know, an energy storage facility that's going to enable more renewables on the grid? So lifetimes of many, many decades is very important. And in my research group, that's one of our focuses. Other people might say, well, for vehicles, people are demanding longer driving distances or faster abilities to charge faster. That's something that we can improve upon, too.
Mm. So let's explore the lithium-ion battery a little bit, which I think, you know, people will be familiar from this, for example, from their cell phones, as the batteries that power their cell phones. What were some of the sort of things that the lithium-ion battery kind of enabled? What did it allow us to do that we weren't able to do before that?
Well, almost everything we can think of. I mean, sometimes we perhaps don't even recall how important they are in our everyday lives. My name is Linda Nazar, and I'm a professor and Canada Research Chair at the University of Waterloo in the Department of Chemistry and the Institute of Nanotechnology. And I work on rechargeable batteries. I work on mostly rechargeable lithium-ion batteries, but on a whole range of different types of electrochemical energy storage devices.
Both Linda and Jeff are working on developing new technologies in lithium-ion batteries as they become more in demand. That's both in number, but also in how much sustained power they can put out and how quickly they can be recharged.
So they enabled all of the portable electronic technology, not just camcorders and cell phones, but a range of different devices. Portable electronics in general. And of course, now they're enabling electric vehicles. They will be enabling and are enabling robots. Nobody wants a plug-in robot.
And so right.
And so the field of robotics is really very dependent on lithium-ion batteries in a way that one might not imagine. But, you know, it's not going to be running around with a lead-acid battery in its back. Drones, for example, unmanned aerial vehicles, new technology that is going to be dependent on, power that is mobile, like electric mobility. So I think anywhere, I mean, people can think of them from hand power tools to lawnmowers, things that we use in our everyday life that we're very familiar with. Perhaps people have, you know, the little house vacuum cleaner that runs around, the iRobot that runs around on the floor. Mm-hmm. Just a panoply of devices in our everyday life that I think we don't even think about that are powered by lithium-ion. Yeah. And then those bigger things are probably even more important in our everyday life to come.
Yeah. And just maybe this is an obvious question, but what is it about lithium-ion batteries that make it so good for all of these portable applications?
So when we think about storing energy, obviously one wants to be able to, the more energy you can store in a smaller volume in a lighter weight, you know, the better off one is.
Right.
And of course, then if that energy can be stored reliably so that you, you know, you can get the energy back again when you recharge your cell, that's great. And if it lasts a long time over many recharge cycles, that's even better. So there's all these considerations to take into account. And, you know, lithium-ion batteries are effectively designed, especially these days now, to be optimized for all of those characteristics and qualities. And so what makes them effectively unique, because they are unique, is that lithium is very lightweight. If you've ever seen a periodic table, there it is sitting up in the top left-hand corner, sort of not very far from hydrogen. So it really adds to the low weight of the battery. Mm-hmm. And its position, trying to think of terms that are not too complicated, but it basically provides a lot of energy as well because of its at the energy at which it releases an electron. Let's just try to be really simple. And so it is actually the most electronegative of the elements in the periodic table, I guess in the sense of, or electropositive, if you want to think of those terms. In other words, the energy that you can get from a lithium ion is greater than any other element in the periodic table, just to put it into simple terms.
Okay.
So you get more energy and you get it at, it provides that energy at a low mass or low weight. They're very small ions. And so they're able to move around in solids in these materials that are the electrode materials fairly readily. And so it's a combination for the lithium ion of being low mass, high energy in the sense that it releases its electron at an optimum energy, and being a small size that makes it special.
Well, I was one of very many people around the world that was involved in developing rechargeable lithium and lithium ion batteries back in the 70s and 80s and then the early 90s. So I was working at a company called Moly Energy Limited in Vancouver from 1985 to 1990. And we were working on batteries that had lithium metal as one, as the negative electrode. And we learned that those batteries had safety-related issues. So around 1987, we started working on the lithium-ion technology. And we developed functional lithium-ion cells. And we were sort of in a race with the Japanese scientists at the same time. And the Japanese commercialized lithium-ion around 1991. Sony was the first. And Moly was ready to commercialize in 1994.
Right. And so what did that lithium ion technology open up? Like, what opportunities did it create, for example, with battery powered cars and the like?
Well, it's actually pretty interesting the way this evolved. So in the beginning, people said, oh, the lithium ion battery is really only suited for computers and phones because you can't discharge them fast. They don't have any power capability. And when you want power capability, you have to use nickel metal hydride or a lead acid. But then around, 2000, it was Moly Energy in Vancouver that did this first, developed high power lithium ion batteries and put them in power tools. So Moly Energy worked with Milwaukee Electric Tools to make the first lithium ion powered drills. And then that took off, the power tool market just expanded. And nowadays you can't buy a battery powered power tool that's not lithium ion. And then around 2008 is when Tesla built the first Tesla Roadster using lithium ion batteries. And then people realized, hey, these batteries can also power vehicles too. You know, and then since then it's just exploded in all aspects. You know, you can buy a lithium ion powered snowblower, for example.
Right. So when you look at where we're at now, what are some of the major limitations or challenges of battery technology right now? Like, what are we trying to improve?
Well, everyone always wants more, you know, it's called energy density, but basically energy per unit, either volume or mass. And so we're always trying to improve that as best possible because that allows our devices to run for longer. And, you know, who doesn't want a battery that makes their cell phone function for 4 weeks without charging it? Sorry to say, it's impossible, but anyway. That would be a dream. I guess there's the concern of always trying to pack more energy into a smaller volume. And then there's also the concern of safety when batteries are starting to get larger and larger now, for example, for electric vehicles or for drones, for not maybe large scale, but certainly larger scale than your portable phone. Safety does become more of quite a concern. And because there's so much energy packed into a small volume or small device, there's always going to be problems. It's almost inevitable. I mean, I would say that lithium-ion batteries are amongst the safest things around, quite honestly, but inevitably there will be some problems with manufacturing. And so, in short, I think that some of the ways that we're trying to move it in the next just 10 years are to come up with different concepts, even for lithium-ion batteries, that will make them safer. So, for example, there's quite a push towards developing solid-state lithium-ion batteries, where they don't, so that there currently our batteries have a liquid that serves as the transport medium in the cell to move the ions back and forth between these two positive plus and minus electrodes. And that electrolyte is an organic solvent that is flammable. And so if you pierce the battery or you subject it to some major abuse, it will be prone to flammability because those organics, just like any organic, will catch fire. So there is a push towards trying to develop solid state batteries that are effectively just that, no organic electrolytes, they're all solid state. And there's real challenges with this. And I think as a community, we're not totally convinced that this is going to work, but we're trying very hard to put that into action.
Can you talk a little bit about your own research?
Well, that's actually a good part of my research, which is
okay.
We're pushing on solid state batteries quite hard. But then there's also really some new developments just in lithium ion batteries themselves, developing better battery architectures, developing fast charging, developing various aspects of safer components for the battery, including the electrolyte. It's not one of these. We haven't seen that. It's more incremental, that work, whereas the solid state battery would really be a leap forward if we were able to get that working really well. Right. But the incremental developments are still very important. And they involve developing new materials for the plus side and new materials for the minus side. So it's all really, it all comes down to a lot of materials chemistry, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And it spans a whole lot of different areas of chemistry. So it's difficult for one person sometimes, or even one group, to make those advances. As you mentioned earlier, it's often done in concert with other groups around the world. So some people focus on one part of the battery and the other people will focus on another, and then eventually it sort of comes together.
I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time, and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, this is Spark, and the second episode of our special 10-part series, The Butterfly Effect. I've been speaking to Jay Turner, who teaches environmental studies and is the author of Charged, A History of Batteries and Lessons for a Clean Energy Future. I'm also talking to battery researchers Jeff Dawn and Linda Nazar.
You're listening to Spark from CBC Radio.
So you asked about what materials go into these more advanced batteries. And, you know, kind of at one level, there's a lot of concern about where we're going to get all of the different highly refined materials that we need for these batteries. And, you know, lithium ion batteries can use a whole wide variety of materials in the anode and cathode. People certainly know about lithium, but lithium is actually a small part of the battery by mass. There's also nickel, aluminum, iron, phosphorus, all of these are materials that can be graphite that are important to these batteries. And so one question is just, where are we going to get all of those materials? How are we going to source them sustainably? How are we going to do it in a way that protects the local communities that are on the front lines of mining and processing these materials? And, you know, and so this is a really urgent question, because we know if we're going to address climate change and transition off of fossil fuels, we need to scale up battery production, but also the supply chains that supply those materials quickly. And so, you know, that's one big challenge. And the other challenge is, you know, can we produce better batteries, right? And so research into kind of the next generation of battery technology. And, you know, one thing I learned from my research on my book Charged is that, you know, the breakthroughs in battery technology are really rare. Batteries tend to improve incrementally as, you know, the materials get better or components of the batteries like separators become improved. And really the history of lithium ion batteries and most other batteries is a history of these incremental improvements. But there, you know, right now there's so much research going on into batteries that, you know, there's going to be a breakthrough, but there are also going to be a lot of incremental gains in the near term.
Can we talk a bit more about some of the materials challenges here? You're an environmental scientist. What are some of the environmental issues surrounding the mining of lithium and other earth elements that we need to produce modern batteries, like the kind that are destined for use in things like electric vehicles, which we're rapidly transitioning to?
Right. I guess one thing is I have a lot of friends who are environmental scientists, but I'm a historian. That's my primary training. But this project for me has been a crash course in material science and, you know, coming to understand the human dimensions of these materials. And, you know, part of the story is that, you know, these advanced batteries require materials that are sourced from, you know, all around the world. And, you know, so if you just take lithium, since people are familiar with that, you know, a significant portion of the lithium comes from salt flats in South America. You know, and so Chile is a major source, but also Argentina, potentially Bolivia. And, you know, there are concerns about water scarcity in the desert areas on these salt flats where lithium is sourced from brine. There are concerns about indigenous communities and their historic interests and presence in these areas. And there have been a number of protests over proposed lithium mines and refining facilities in these areas. And, you know, and so, and then, you know, the concerns about wildlife. These are areas that, you know, where water is scarce and ecosystems are fragile. And, you know, the well-known species that, you know, depend upon, any flamingos that depend upon these salt flats that can be affected by these mining operations as well. But that's only, you know, one source of lithium. The other major source and actually larger source of lithium right now is in Australia. And their lithium isn't sourced from water-based brines. It's sourced from hard rock. And hard rock mining always entails substantial costs because you're mining the material, you're breaking the material apart, you're going to have a lot of waste that comes with this processing. It requires a lot of energy to process this lithium into battery grade materials. And there's always, you know, there's significant risk of pollution that comes with this, but also questions about, you know, what happens when these mines reach the end of their life? How do we plan ahead to make sure they're going to be restored and, you know, and managed in a way that's environmentally safe and socially just for the long term? You know, so whether you're talking about brines or you're talking about hard rocks, you know, really talking about any of these materials, there are always consequences and questions that need to be asked.
Mm-hmm. And there have also been stories about exploitative labor practices in mining lithium. Do you have the sense that those are starting to be addressed as our demand for these elements increases?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of concern about labor practices specifically, and some connected with lithium, but more so connected with cobalt. Which has been an essential component of most of the lithium ion battery chemistries that are used in portable electronics and many of the vehicles. And, you know, one push is just to use less cobalt in batteries. And, you know, the concern is that more than half of the cobalt that is currently in use is being sourced from the Democratic Republic of the Congo,
Yes.
A lot of the mining activity. And the DRC is controlled by Chinese firms that don't have a good record on labor issues. But a portion of the mining activity is artisanal mining, which is happening in ways that are rudimentary, not industrial scale mining, but where people are actually digging into these cobalt reserves by hand with shovels, tunneling down. And it's people who live in the DRC who are looking for opportunities, but it also means that children have been involved in this. And there have been a number of reports, Amnesty International, other groups have focused attention on the significant number of children that are involved in cobalt mining and processing and the cobalt trade in general. And the harm that, many of these injuries that many of these children have suffered, but also, the risk of exposure to heavy metal pollution and other ill consequences of mining cobalt. And, so this has been a major concern. And really, I think it's been an issue that's helped focus attention on the human dimensions, the human consequences of these supply chains that are important to batteries, but also relevant to, other technologies that are important to a clean energy transition.
Cobalt in particular, of course, is it's a mineral that, or it's an element, it's a metal that's present in the battery, not in the metallic state, but it is an element in the battery, found in the positive side. And it's a fairly essential component to the materials that, to the material that makes up that positive electrode. And I'm sure you've heard of the fact that mining cobalt is, first of all, cobalt is not widely found in, across the world. A lot of the deposits are in the Congo, and the mining practices there can be, shall we say, challenged by a lot of politics and difficult mm-hmm. processes. So it is a mineral that is not widely distributed. It is politically, it's problematic. And so the short story is that there is really a push now to develop positive electrode materials for these batteries that do not contain cobalt. And right now they're I wouldn't say they're cobalt free, but they're minimal in cobalt.
I see.
So there's a gamut of batteries. The ones that were on the Dreamliner, for example, that caused all of those problems, those were very, very high in cobalt, actually. But in today's technology, we're moving towards less and less cobalt. That comes with its own set of chemistry problems. So that's certainly one angle that we're trying to move towards. And but there's also problems with lithium and, of course, the other major component of the battery. And then the other critical minerals are nickel to a certain extent, although nickel is more widely available than cobalt, and even copper for the current collectors in the batteries. So there's mineral issues, for all of the main components or the elements that comprise the battery at the moment. And, lithium is not actually, it's not a scarce mineral, but again, it's difficult to mine. Most of it is easily obtainable up in salt fields in the upper deserts of Chile and Bolivia, and to a certain extent Argentina. So that is salt, lithium that's present in salt brine. So it's sort of at the surface or not far beyond the surface, and you can literally excavate it as brine. Whereas other sources of lithium come from hard rock, from a mineral called spodumene. And that involves hard rock mining, and that involves developing mines. For example, in Australia, Canada has some spodumene. Mm-hmm. Other countries do as well. But it's the sort of thing where you have to invest in a mine for 5 years to really make it productive. So it's so there's lots of issues regarding supply chains. But we're getting into recycling in batteries now, and that will ultimately solve, hopefully, some of those problems.
Is there a conversation around, whether we can actually get enough of those minerals to open those mines, get enough of those minerals in order, at the rate at which the demand is increasing, like if we flip over to electric vehicles very quickly, for example, is that part of the conversation in your world?
So there's a number of different aspects, and a further one is, you have to worry about the availability of all the metals and minerals that are needed to make the electrode materials for the lithium-ion batteries going in the future, because the the demand is just exponentially growing over time. So you have to move to more sustainable materials that are abundant and can be sustained at large production levels. So that moves us to look at the cousin of the lithium-ion battery, which is the sodium-ion battery, where sodium is everywhere in the ocean, and it's not going to ever have a limitation in terms of availability. So a lot of people around the world are starting to work on sodium-ion batteries too.
They're not as energy dense as lithium-ion, but if we get to the point where we're really pushing on lithium-ion demand, it would make sense for lithium-ion to be used for more electric mobility purposes, where we really do need to benefit the low mass and higher energy density that that battery can afford, whilst sodium-ion batteries could be used for powering, you know, other type devices where energy, that volume or mass, isn't such a concern. So we shouldn't be necessarily totally focused on the lithium-ion battery. There's other kinds of, we're always storing electrons and releasing them, but the ion that matches that electron flow can vary. And it could be sodium, it could be magnesium, it could be zinc. There's other type of batteries, especially these days, that are being developed. But if we go back to the lithium issue, with the advent of recycling batteries, the scarcity, as I said, lithium is not that scarce. It's actually widely available. And with the advent of recycling batteries, then, you know, it really becomes a much more workable problem, because that lithium that goes into the battery simply comes, gets refined and put back in. So it's a workable problem.
I'm Nora Young, and this is a special episode of Spark looking at the battery. It's part of our series, The Butterfly Effect, about how apparently small technological advancements have changed the world. I'm speaking to historian and environmental studies professor Jay Turner and battery researchers Linda Nazar and Jeff Dawn. Although we've become largely dependent on lithium batteries, there are still challenges in meeting the expected need for stored energy as more and more people start using electric vehicles and even begin powering their homes with batteries.
Yeah, for sure. You know, right now, there's a lot of batteries that are being used in homes. So the Tesla Powerwall is a good example of a home energy storage unit that you can buy in your home. And if you lose power from the grid, it can run your home for some period of time. Actually, my electric vehicle has a adapter on the that you plug into the charge port. It's called vehicle to load. So you plug in and you get AC power out of this adapter. So we recently had Hurricane Fiona here.
Yeah.
And we used the vehicle to load option to power our refrigerator and some lights and so on.
Wow, that's cool.
for the eight days until power was restored,
man.
You know. So
wow.
So these kind of things, it's way better than a generator. Because it's when you run a generator, you're using fuel continuously at the same rate, even if you're not drawing any power from the generator.
Mm-hmm.
When you're using the vehicle to load option on the battery, it's only supplying electricity as needed. You know, the fridge turns on and off on a cycle. And when it's not drawing power, the battery in the car is not being drained at all. So it's really nice to have an EV parked outside, which can run your home if necessary.
So we're starting to see this demand increase, for example, for electric vehicles. But can you imagine a time when batteries will be used to provide energy for homes or maybe even communities or towns?
Oh, I mean, I would say that right now batteries are being used for homes. Lithium-ion batteries are being used for homes. There's things like power walls being, many people in California are installing power walls in their homes for, you know, to prevent against, or not prevent, but to try to help them with their way through blackouts. So again, it's my personal opinion that probably at the initial stages, lithium ion batteries will be used for those purposes. For example, we call them mini grids, where, for example, you have solar panels on your roof. Those can be used to create energy that is then stored in your home battery and delivered back to the grid if you have an excess. Or simply if you're not using, if you're a big energy user, then it's obviously used in your house. So the mini grid concept for communities or a home battery are a thing I would say already certainly encroaching on our market. And they don't have to be lithium ion at present. Most of the power wall systems, and I'm using that as just because it's probably the most well-known name, but there's others as well, are already in use and will continue to be in use and will probably ultimately be replaced by lower cost batteries that don't need the energy density, as I said, that lithium ion provides. It's a stationary battery, and as long as it doesn't take up a large volume, it can be, you know, put in an area of your house. And it can also be, for example, it could use water as an electrolyte, which is a lot safer. So there's lots of options for community batteries and home batteries that will be, I think, poking their nose up above the horizon pretty quickly.
Well, solar and wind at the moment are the most cost-effective source of generating primary electricity. So they're cheaper than building a new coal plant or whatever you want to try to do. Solar and wind are the cheapest. So you want to go solar and wind, you know, and then you have to think about when they're not available, what are you going to do? So, you know, here in our province, we have not too many battery storage facilities at the moment, but there are some big ones proposed. And also what we're trying to do here is set up something called the Atlantic Loop, which is to connect transmission lines to Quebec so that when solar and wind is not available, we can use hydro-generated electricity flowing in from Quebec so that we can be 100% renewable, I think, by 2035 or something like that. Your question was how viable is battery storage? Well, it's happening today in many, many places. Large battery storage facilities are going in. I think a really good example is one in Ontario that's a partnership between a company called NR Store and the Oneida First Nation, where there's a very large battery storage facility going in southwestern Ontario. It's 1 gigawatt hour of storage, which could power 1/20th of Nova Scotia for an entire day in there. So that's going to be a big facility. I think it'll be the biggest in Canada.
So does the future mean that one day we might not need these complex electrical grids that we have now, or is that always going to be part of the picture?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm not sure how the grid is going to evolve, because when everybody has electric vehicles, you're going to need a lot more electricity generation than we have today just to charge all of them. And so how are you going to do that? Are you going to have big central generating facilities or more distributed smaller things like windmills here and there and solar farms here and there? It's really hard for me to predict how things will go. But one thing that I have heard is, you know, once you get electric vehicle uptake of around 15-20% of the population, you know, then at that point, the current grid and the current generating capacity is going to have to do things like say, look, if all you people want to charge your cars at 5 p.m., we're not going to be able to do it. You're going to have to stagger the charging and sort of let us control when your vehicles are being charged. And in fact, we might even have to borrow some charge from you guys that are fully charged to charge guys that are less charged, you know, but make sure all of you have enough charge to get where you want to go the next day. So there'll be a lot of apps on your phone and so on to control this type of thing. I think that's the way it's going to go.
Do you think we might get to the point where solar and wind power technologies are good enough that they'll generate enough electricity to charge all the batteries that we'll be using?
Yes. You know, one thing that has really become clear in the last decade is just how rapidly wind, solar, also hydroelectricity, but especially wind and solar, you know, just how rapidly they are scaling up as the prices have fallen and kind of the infrastructure for deploying those technologies has become easier. And, you know, that's going to continue. You know, wind and solar are the least cost solutions for deploying new electric capacity. Now, there's still the question of how to manage the storage side, but, you know, it seems very plausible that they could meet meet the increased demand for electricity that will come with electrifying vehicles and homes and shifting off of fossil fuels. You know, that's not to say it's going to be an easy transition, but it's a transition that seems plausible and doable in a way that, you know, 20 years ago, it didn't seem like we really could displace coal or natural gas from the electric grid. And now it just seems like, you know, it's a matter of, you know, how quickly might this happen?
And just finally, Linda, on this series, we're kind of looking at the kind of long-term impacts of specific technological innovations. Would you care to hazard an opinion as to what our lives would be like if the battery had never been invented?
That's an interesting question. Well, we wouldn't be as connected technologically as we are now. I mean, the digital age really depends on batteries to a great degree. So I guess we'd be sitting at home and we'd be talking with friends and not doing so much in an interconnected global way. Take us back to the, you know, early 1900s when things were very different. But in terms of the mobility and the digital technology that we're familiar with, of course, that would be completely lacking because batteries are absolutely essential to that. So we would be back to the days of phoning up friends on our handheld, you know, handsets that are wired into the wall. I don't know that any of us could go back there. Let's hope we don't have to.
The lithium-ion battery, we'll talk about that one, because the lithium-ion battery really has changed our lives. You know, there would not be smartphones without the lithium-ion battery. The other battery technologies are just not compatible. And think about what a smartphone can do. You know, you wouldn't have electric vehicles of any reasonable capability without lithium-ion batteries. And, you know, because of the impact that lithium-ion batteries have had, John Goodenough, Akira Yoshino, and Stan Whittingham won the 2019 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their fundamental contributions that they made that enabled the whole thing. And that was all back in the late 70s and early 80s. The Nobel Prize really recognizes things that change our lives. And it was very fitting that finally the lithium-ion battery was honored with this prize.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Would we just have had really long electric cords plugging everything in? When you think, I've always thought of batteries, you know, not so much as a technology, but as an enabling technology, because, you know, batteries have certainly gotten better over time, but the things they enable is really what's been important and been the driver. You know, how would kind of car culture look different if everybody still had to crank the engine to start the car? You know, how important would portable applications be if, you know, microprocessors hadn't, you know, accelerated their development, you know, by orders of magnitude and, you know, since the 1980s. And so, you know, in my mind, you know, what's interesting about thinking about batteries is just how important they've been to enabling the systems of, you know, communication, transportation, and electrification that, you know, we came to depend on in the 20th century. And, you know, batteries going to be even more important to that as we move into a clean energy 21st century.
Jay Turner is the author of Charged, A History of Batteries and Lessons for a Clean Energy Future. He teaches environmental studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Linda Nazar holds the Canada Research Chair in Solid State Energy Materials at the University of Waterloo. Jeff Don is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Chemistry at Dalhousie University and is Principal Investigator of the NSERC Tesla Canada Dalhousie Alliance Grant. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Adam Killick, Olsi Sorokina, Samruit Johannes, and me, Nora Young. And by Jay Turner, Jeff Don, and Linda Nazar. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.